it had never occurred to me when I was first out of work that I would never have a regular full-time staff job again. And now here we are many years later, and I have never had a regular employer again.
This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of our live event series. Haymarket Books is a radical, independent publisher dedicated to connecting social movements with the ideas they need in the struggle for a better world. You can help support the Haymarket Project by buying books at haymarketbooks.org and especially by joining the Haymarket Book Club. By joining the book club, you get all new Haymarket titles delivered to your door and a 50% discount on the entire Haymarket website, all for one low price. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast and the Haymarket YouTube channel to access all of our upcoming events. If you really want to help us out, rate and review the podcast on Apple or whatever platform you're listening on.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for coming today. I'm so happy to be moderating this event. We're here to celebrate the publication of our collection, Going for Broke, Living on the Edge in the World's Richest Country, which has something like 50 contributors. And it's the culmination of nearly 10 years of Economic Hardship Reporting Project, a nonprofit I created with the great Barbara Ehrenreich. Barbara, the author of 21 books, including Nickel and Dimed and Fear of Falling, started EHRP after the 2008 recession when it further harmed the reporting profession. We created EHRP because we believe it shouldn't only be the rich that are reporting on poverty in this country. We need to have people who experience economic struggle firsthand telling their stories with beauty, immediacy, and wit. We recruited, edited, raised money to fund hundreds of independent reporters, some who've been laid off, some who live in non-coastal communities, And among the laid off, there were surprises. I'm talking about writers like the brilliant public broadcaster Ray Suarez, who himself faced economic instability in the later half of his career after having been a correspondent and anchor at the public television nightly newscast, PBS NewsHour, and NPR's Talk of the Nation. He's here with us today. Among those who experienced the hardships around housing and not being housed were writers like Alex Miller, a Navy veteran. When he couldn't afford the aspiring writer's life, Miller moved into a shelter, and he's rebounded and he's publishing widely, including in this collection tonight. And he's here too to talk about it. He's a fellow at EHRP. A third contributor joining us is Annabelle Gurwitch, an actress and best-selling author of 5 books, her most recent called You're Leaving When? Adventures in Downward Mobility. And the title kind of gets at her sense of humor, her dark sense of humor. She herself experienced financial bumps in midlife. And finally, we're graced with the well-known Nation columnist, Katha Pollitt. She contributed thoughts about a documentary poem about abortion. We at EHRP see the right to abortion and economically secure pregnancy as fundamental income inequality. I'd like to get started with Ray, and I'm hoping he can tell us a little bit about the situation he writes about in the essay that appears on our collection. And you also spoke about it in the podcast that we did. We did 2 seasons. It's called Going for Broke as well. So Ray, lay it out. Explain what you wrote about.
Well, I had been working for decades, moving basically from one job to the next, steadily climbing the greasy pole. And then as I began to think about retirement in the last years of my career, Al Jazeera pulled the plug. I was anchoring a daily news program at Al Jazeera America. They told me when I signed up that I could count on X amount of time before the thing would have to start making money and start drawing audience. Well short of that, they decided that they had had enough of the losses of the massive Red Ink, and they just pulled the plug. And suddenly I was out of work, but I wasn't worried. I thought, well, look, I have this resume. I have this body of work. I have this reputation. People know I'm not a nut or hard to work with or anything like that. And I thought, I wasn't worried. I'll just get another job. I assumed that the next job would not pay as well. It might not have the same perch. But whether I could work or not, I had no doubt at all. I just knew that I'd get something else and go back to work. And a lot of this was predicated on my own plans and ideas about when I would stop work, when I would start to draw on Social Security and retirement savings and that kind of thing. And being terminally unemployed at 59 just wasn't in my plans. And that worry did not go away. It just kept mounting as people who were very excited, they said they were very excited to talk to me, didn't return my calls. People who I ran into who said, oh, yes, let's absolutely get together to talk about this or that project, just ghosted me. People who actually made initial inquiries about hiring me never spoke to me again. And then I started to panic a little bit because I really needed to work. I really needed to work for myself, but also for the very practical reason that there were monthly expenses and weekly expenses, and, you know, they had to get paid. And it had never occurred to me when I was first out of work that I would never have a regular full-time staff job again. And now here we are, many years later, and I have never had a regular employer again. I'm making money again. But what I write about in the essay is the kind of anxiety you have not only about the electric bill and the insurance bill, but also the worries that you have about where you fit, who you are anymore, where you fit into a place like Washington, D.C. If somebody says, this is very much a what do you do kind of place. Well, if someone asks you what you do and you haven't had a job in a year, well, yeah. What do you do? Do you say, I'm a reporter? And they say, where? Naturally. And you say, well, nowhere, because I don't work anymore. It was a totally disorienting kind of thing. And it was in that spirit that I wrote about falling down, that sinking feeling, and worrying about both the dreams that I had for my later years and the actual circumstances I was living under, which frankly, I still don't understand, but I have to find a kind of repose about it and a kind of serenity about it, because even though it's not true what they say about quicksand, that if you start to struggle when you're in it, you sink faster. Those stories about quicksand are not true, but it turns out that you sink whether you struggle or not. So that sinking feeling is about that.
And you published this essay that we have, and you put it very beautifully. It's sort of a losing the storyline thread of the traditional life that you'd led, and that there's economic, but there's existential dimensions as well, right? And you sort of get at that.
Absolutely, because, you know, I would get an invitation to something like a book launch. There are a lot of them here. And I would put on one of my old Anchorman outfits and take the metro downtown and walk into this place and look around the room and realize I'm probably the only unemployed person in this room. And when people say to me, hey, where are you now? What's my answer? It's not nowhere. I wouldn't, even though that was true, I wouldn't say, well, I'm nowhere. I would try to come up with an answer that made it sound like I was busy, because that's part of the imperative of being in this world too. You got to be busy. You have to have some sort of defining work that helps you explain what you're up to. And losing that it's not the end of your life. I mean, let's be honest, it's not the end of your life. But until you come to some peace about how to be, it is totally, totally like the trap door fell out from under your feet. And you don't know how far you're going to fall. You don't know where you're going to land. And you don't know what it's going to feel like.
Yeah, it's so well put, Ray. And the intensity of this piece and the sense of humor too come through, and I really advise people to read it as well in the book. So I also wanted to reach out to Alex. Alex is one of our fellows, and he writes a lot about his experience and also reports generally on other stuff like video games and, you know, unrelated. But can you briefly discuss your essay in the collection? What's it about, the life experience that led you to write it?
Yeah, absolutely. My piece in the book just covers my experiences with not only the military, but everything that happened after the military. My experience with the VA was and still is not so great. Going into the VA always felt like a defeat before I even started my day. Being homeless at the time that I was, it was still part of the recession, and there weren't a lot of jobs going around for anybody, let alone vets. People just had this sort of feeling towards veterans that showed on their faces. You know, it was a thing that they wore with them every time I spoke to somebody and I tried to say, well, I'm a veteran. And you could just tell, you know, there was this animosity towards us. It was really disheartening for me to have to operate in that space. So my essay just covers my experience from being in the homeless shelter to going into the SRO, which was even worse. Lots of drugs, lots of violence in the SRO. It just felt like I had flown out of the hood only to land back in it. And I thought, well, this isn't where my life was supposed to go. I was supposed to join the military and things were supposed to get better. That's how my life was supposed to turn out. Having to deal with the bureaucracy of the VA and not having them help you until you gave them a reason to help you. It was something that I had to find out pretty quickly from older vets. They said, you know, you can't just go in there and tell the people how you're feeling. You might have to put on a little show. Some vets would go in and try to request benefits, but they would be turned away because the VA wouldn't treat them the same way as other vets who looked like they were in more desperation. Well, fortunately and unfortunately for me, I was at my wit's end. I was ready to jump out a window. So once I started going to the VA and talking about, hey, listen, I'm ready to hang it up right now, people started to really pay attention to what I was talking about. It was hard to get mental health care. It was hard to get regular health care. But When people start to think of your situation as something that could put you on the news or could turn into another statistic, that's when they start making differences.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of what was powerful about that was that your story is incredible and the way you access your emotions around it, but also how some of it is almost like pain signaling. You had to sort of perform your pain. You had to visibly look disheveled. Like you described it. It was you went into the offices doing that, right?
Yeah. That was part of the process, and it was so unfortunate because these people are supposed to be here to help you, but you know, so many of them didn't even like veterans, which is something I found out. And I was like, well, that's kind of weird. It's like on the the building, it says Veterans Administration. What are you guys here doing? What's the point?
So, you're not administrating.
Yeah.
Getting this out when you write about this experience, like what does that do for your feelings about it? Or do people write to you and say, I had this too, this happened to me? Or yeah.
Yeah, I do get that a lot. I make contact with a lot of different vets who are very appreciative of me talking about these issues, because so many veterans don't have the platforms that I do. And so it helps me when I can help them. We are so often in positions of disempowerment as veterans. And I will give you a perfect example. It's Veterans Day coming up Saturday. I got an email from the VA telling me which places I can go to get free coffee or donuts. And that's what the VA thinks of us. Hey, let's talk about these guys went today, pat ourselves on the back. And here's a donut. Attaboy. So it's like, you know, it's not Veterans Year. It's Veterans Day. And that's what I feel a lot of people think that's yeah. what we need. That is what will help us. So
donuts and coffee.
Yeah.
If only. We'll return with questions for those two, but I wanted to talk to Annabelle a little bit. Annabelle Gerwich over here, who you also knew Barbara Ehrenreich well, and that was how I first met you. And you wrote an essay for us that also involved your personal experience of experiencing economic uncertainty, but also changing how you thought about other people who had experienced economic uncertainty. Do you want to tell us a little bit about it?
Yes, you know, I have something in common with Ray's experience, although I've always been a freelancer as an actress and as a writer, and that was more of an expectation for me. But the kind of downward mobility I was experiencing was also triggered, as it is for a lot of women in particular, which statistically women are hit harder after a divorce in midlife. When I was experiencing that moment, and this essay talks about what I did, one of my strategies to keep myself afloat, and how I ended up participating. I was the seventh person in Los Angeles to open my home to youth experiencing homelessness as part of a program, which is a supportive housing program called the Host Home Program, which at the time that I did this, which was I had a couple of youth and their, it was a male and a female couple and their rabbit living in my guest bedroom. The rabbit was really unexpected. And
hide your wires, they chew wires, rabbits. Anyway, yeah.
There was some damage done, but it was okay. This program, when I volunteered to be part of it, and it was part of the reason I did this program was because there was a stipend available for homeowners with an extra bedroom who would be willing to do this program. At the time, it was only in a few cities. Now it's been launched. A great source of information is Point Source Youth, who innovated this program. And it's in about 40 cities in America now. And I wanted to write about this experience. And the essay was first published in Los Angeles Times, which I got death threats afterwards because people were very upset. Readers felt that I was encouraging people to move to Los Angeles young people who would eventually experience homelessness, and that you know, it was a very mixed response that I got. I wanted to address not only the way that I was, I felt this program was so innovative in that it was a temporary housing solution that doesn't need building infrastructure. It's so sustainable. But in particular, also, what I wanted to address was how that experience made me confront my own otherisms in two ways in particular that I'll speak to briefly. One was that I, like many people, had noticed a rise in unhoused people in Los Angeles. But like so many people, I misunderstood who was experiencing homelessness, especially in terms of youth. I was mistaken in the thought that I didn't know that the majority of young people experiencing homelessness in Los Angeles were local youth who had had some kind of system involvement, who had aged out of the foster care system, whose families simply couldn't afford to support them at home anymore, or whose sexual orientation had meant they become unhoused. That was something that I also wasn't aware. I mean, that was profoundly eye-opening. I also wasn't aware that so many, and this is, you know, this was something I think we've all, since the years since I wrote this piece, it was right before the pandemic, that so many working people were living in their cars, as this couple was, teachers, students. There's a large percentage of college students in America. So who the unhoused were in terms of, in particular, youth wasn't clear for me. But furthermore, this experience really made me look at myself and my own mythology that I had in terms of how I had risen from a background where we had once lost our home and had to live with family, but I had underestimated the privilege I had had based on the location, the zip code that I grew up in, and having grown up in a community where my family wasn't wealthy, but the community was wealthier, and that had given me mm-hmm. such a leg up in terms of connections, in terms of my ability to navigate the system, that I had to rethink my personal mythology. And Alyssa, you wrote about this in your book, Bootstrapped. I had some of that. I've done this myself. I'm embarrassed to say I really felt that much more than it was true. And I had so much more in common with my house guests. And then the places where our experiences differed, it was so clear that some of that experience where we differed was due to where the locations we had grown up and the kind of mentoring we had received and exposure we had received. And so that essay that was written with a grant from EHRP really was something that is I write about in a longer version in my book, You're Leaving When, but it really changed profoundly the way I saw experiencing homelessness and my own story. So that was the motivation for publishing that story.
I mean, that's such a good point about zip code, because I see that a lot, even my own reporting, but also in some of the folks we work with when, and this is like Raj Chetty and these kind of economists write about that, like how much where location and where you grow up mm-hmm. as much as who you grow up with shapes right. you, right?
And that's, you know, I wanted just to make another point. You know, one of the pushback I got to this piece was, now it just so happened that the young people that I housed were people who weren't, they didn't grow up in Los Angeles. They did come to Los Angeles to be artists, to be musicians. They are outliers in terms of the larger population of unhoused youth in LA. But the pushback I got was, well, so are you encouraging young people to come to LA to be artists? And you know, what it made me think about this was I never encourage anyone to go into the arts. It's like an addiction. When someone says to me their child in particular wants to be an actor, I say, what is going on in your household?
Yeah.
We must have an intervention.
But writer, forget about it. Yes.
But I said, well, yes, they want to be artists, but they come from a part of the country. It happens to be in Pennsylvania that has been decimated by fracking. They come from this this what used to be working class family. Their experiences in one of they grew up in a county with one of the highest opioid addiction rates in the country. I said, who do we want to hear from in the arts? I want to about the American experience. I want to hear from them. So yes, I do want to encourage them to be artists. What, are we going to only hear from the children of famous people? No, this is the Nepo babies, as they've been called. Right. This is who we want to hear from. So it really made me rethink all my narratives.
Oh, I love that. That's a great point. So we'll return to the story of Annabelle, but I'd like to check in with Katha Pollitt, the columnist, who is also a poet. Can you tell us what you contributed to the book? And I guess part of this is the second question would be, how in your mind does women's health and reproductive rights intersect with poverty? Because that was part of what we worked on in this book in Going for Broke.
I just want to say this is a wonderful anthology. I've been reading it. It's just terrific. It's so varied, so many different voices and different experiences, and people bringing their full selves to their story. It's just great. So my own contribution was an introduction to a poem written by the very modest Alyssa Court, who hasn't mentioned that. And it's a poem about women in the waiting room waiting for their abortion and all the different kinds of experiences that brought them there. And a couple of things struck me. And one is that how hard their lives were in every way, in financially, but also emotionally, that they didn't get a lot of support. Their mother is full of God, and so she's telling them, "Don't, you can't do this. Where are the boyfriends and the husbands?" There's like one there, and the others, you know, who knows what's happened to them. And it's very moving, and it's very sad. And it's you know, we tend to think outside of the waiting room, we often think of abortion in terms of sisterhood, that old-fashioned word that people are banding together and they're helping each other and all that. And this makes you realize how isolated those women are, often are, and how much they've gone through just to get there. I've written a lot about poor women and abortion because people, you know, this is what really infuriates me about the whole thing is like when the typical person thinks about, oh, who has abortions? They think sexy college student, woman who hates children. They have these stereotypes, and they don't think low income woman who already has three kids. And because most women, this is very important, most women who have abortions are already mothers. It's like, I think it's like 60%. And most of them are low income, and most of them a disproportionate number are black, and they've had very difficult lives. And I think it's just so wonderful that abortion is something. What I really like about being involved in abortion support is this is an area where you can actually solve a problem. You know, you can't solve all the problems of a poor person. You probably can't rent them an apartment. I mean, or let most people are probably not going to want to let them live in their house like Anna does. But you can solve this one problem. And that's a really marvelous thing. Another area that people don't think about enough, although that's changing, I want to say some things about that in a minute, is that often an abortion is a medical experience, and it's that you're having for a medical reason. It's not that you just suddenly decided, oh, after all, I don't want to have a baby. I thought I did, but now I'm 30 weeks pregnant and forget it, which is another stereotype people have, is that women are very lazy and very, just don't solve this problem soon enough. And this is why, the idea of time limits, the Republicans keep hoping will get traction because... And I had a friend once. I was giving a party for a fundraising party, and one of my best friends said to me, "Well, Kava, I think 15 weeks is plenty of time to make up your mind." She didn't get it at all. But she's learned because now she has no memory of ever having said that, which is kind of funny. But what was I going to say? That people just, as so many of the stories in this book reveal, do not understand how hard life is for other people. If they're not going through the thing, it doesn't happen. And even if they have gone through it, they went through it in a different way. So that there are, like, for example, in the case of abortion, that if you have an abortion, there are women who have abortions because there's something catastrophically wrong with the fetus. And they might not think that what they're doing is the same as what a woman who's having an abortion because she can't support another child or because she never wants to have a child or whatever. Or she wants to have a baby, but not when she's 18. So it's like people have so many ways, and society encourages people in so many ways not to make those connections, to think I'm special. It's different when I do it. And there's this old joke of like, I'm for abortion. Oh, it's rape, incest, and me. Those are the three acceptable reasons to have an abortion.
So, yeah, you're getting at a lot of things, and part of we've divided this book Going for Broke into sections, and that section that you and I are in is called the body. And part of why I thought it was really important to start with the body is that often writing about the economy, writing about poverty ignores bodies, women's bodies, disability, sickness, like these basic things that are part of the materiality of, income inequality, right? It becomes kind of airier. And so I really thought it was great to start with that because I wanted to have repro and queer and disability rights. And these are the intense political fights. These are the things that obviously, look at Ohio, people really, really care about this. And they decide who gets to live as themselves and who gets to live at all, I think, some of these questions, right? So that's part of why I thought it was important for us to have these voices in this book in the beginning. It was right after Dobbs when we were putting it together. Yeah.
I wanted to make a comment, which is I think that what you're talking about, Kath, and what all of us have talked about is part of the legacy, I think, that Barbara Ehrenreich left us is that she not only wrote about these trends, social issues, social critic, but illuminating people's lives in a very humanistic, individual way. I mean, she really pioneered that with Nickeled and Dimed, which I think was shocking for some people, but for anyone who lived that life, not at all shocking. And I think some of the stories, and many of the stories in the anthology, and I was really knocked out, Ray, by when you write about how having an accident on your bike in one and having recently decided to not have a dental insurance, in one day you could just go from someone who has economic security to possibly falling through the safety net. And this really humanizes things. And I think that that's a really important element of the storytelling that EHRP supports, is very human.
Thank you. Yeah. I mean, I definitely think so. And I feel like, you know, the bodily, the human without being individualistic in a way that, because sometimes things can be so individual that then they stop being political, right? So I think Barbara saw that you do use that, the individual as a portal to telling a broader political story, right? It can't just be like the feature, the typical feature magazine story that's, it gets lost in the details of the one person, right? It's the whole idea is like, let's see the world through that person, the pinhole of the individual that is writing their story, you know?
If you're enjoying the Haymarket Live series, you'll also be interested in a new book from Haymarket, Care, The Highest Stage of Capitalism, by Premila Nadasen. In this eye-opening reckoning with the care economy, scholar Premila Nadasen traces its logic and history from its roots in racial capitalism and slavery to its exponential growth as a site of profit and extraction. Today's care economy, she shows, is an institutionalized, hierarchical system in which some people's pain translates into other people's profit. As Sarah Jaffe puts it, in clear and concise prose, Nadasen takes apart the care industrial complex that has emerged, like the military and prison industrial complexes before it, to wring the last drops of profit from the lives and deaths of working people. An absolutely necessary intervention in the most important political debate of our times. Find Care, The Highest Stage of Capitalism at haymarketbooks.org.
So yeah, I wanted to return with a few questions for folks. Ray, you said on our podcast something really interesting. You said that Latino means young in the American media. And I thought it's brilliant and interesting. And I wanted you to talk about how what you mean by this and how ageism plays into income inequality, because I feel like that's another theme in this book.
Well, after the Second World War, sociologists started to write about the idea of a master status. Of all the variables about a person, what's the one that's going to be determinative of your life chances and life outcomes? And in the 50s and 60s, they were talking about race as a master status. And I started to think about master status again when, in effect, getting old meant I wasn't Puerto Rican anymore. I was just old because the way that future possible employers were relating to me had far more to do with the fact that I was in my 60s. Even these professed champions of diversity in their workforce, I was kind of deracinated by the fact that I was getting old. And they could only see me as an old guy, even though I wanted to work and made it very clear that I intended to work for years and years to come. What they wanted was someone who was peppy, obviously ethnic and cheap. And I could still do the peppy part, but it took a while to sink in, really, that they didn't regard me that way because I had a long resume, so I wasn't going to be their find. That people were already familiar with my work, but really they didn't see me as that kind of hire anymore. Someone who would add a bit of color to the workforce, unless the color they were talking about was gray. And the ageism in broadcasting is terrible, unless you're already established and never leave. You can't get old on the air. And I thought, well, look, yes, I'm old, but I'll work at radio. I don't sound old. I don't sound creaky. I don't sound over the hill. This won't be a problem. But it was a problem. And
it should not have been a problem. everybody's listening and knows that it should not have been a problem. So, Alex, I wanted to actually go back to how you define yourself complexly, because I know that's not quite what this piece in Going for Broke is, but because we work together a lot, I love that you always try to underline that you may have experienced, PTSD as a vet and, you know, housing struggles and all this kind of thing, but you're also really into video games, you're a millennial, you're a big reader, you know, you probably have other kinds of fun-identities that too that you'd want to share. But like that, why is that important, do you think, if we're talking about this kind of the individual that leads to something more humanistic and political, like why is that important to give that shading to who you are on the page? Because I think it is, but I'd love to hear your words.
I think that a lot of people who don't know or don't want to hear from millennials need to hear from millennials. I think that they need to know what we're thinking about, how we feel about topics. I think that people who are millennials, who play games, who were raised on Super Mario and still play games, and we're going to keep doing it until we're 95, that covers a portion of the population. People are not really talking about, you know, and gamers and the benefits of gaming are something that are known to such a small amount of America. I feel that I have to write about these things and share these stories, because that goes into my other title as an essayist. You know, it is the nature of the human condition to share these stories with people who may or may not know what it's like to go through these things. And so by doing this, I reinforce who I am. I represent for all of the communities that I can lay claim to. And I make people care about an issue that needs to be spoken about, because there are so many topics, there are so many issues that swirl around in our minds every day. They're all vying for attention. You have to make people care about your issue. Otherwise, what does it matter? Why are you even doing this? What is the point?
Yeah, I mean, you've written about living in an SRO and all kinds of things too. And then you write about gaming, and I just think that we're made of multitudes, kind of, you know. You're part of multiple communities, ones that people may not have read that much about, and ones that what they inhabit themselves, you know. And that seems really important to me, that people aren't just one thing on the page. So. Moving on to Annabelle, I mean, you know, I guess I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about health, but you've written extensively about health recently, and that was part of your experience of economic distress, right? Was the cost of healthcare later and on in your life, right? I mean, or would you say that, or?
I mean, I think many people are aware that the majority of bankruptcies in this country are driven from medical costs, and GoFundMe has become a de facto health insurance program, which is completely unsustainable. And that was part of the driver for me experiencing economic downward mobility, because in the past, my health insurance had always come through earned income through my union coverage that came through this tied to my employer. And of course, that's a paradigm that's really changing in America and is so rare now, that you get income with a benefit, that you have a job with benefits. And this is a driving factor for so many people's financial insecurity now. And most recently, people who followed my work at all, I've been publishing in the New York Times and Washington Post. And most recently with EHRP, I published a piece in the Washington Post about predatory practices in insurance that I ran into because I was diagnosed with lung cancer during COVID and suddenly fell into this hugely expensive chronic condition that has so many inequities, not just that impact me personally, but it was it's been a window for me. And just one example that I want to speak to is I'm taking a medication that turns off one gene in your body that has been keeping me stable for 3 years, which is just really extraordinary. It's one of the sort of new emerging precision medications. And it's fantastic, only it depends on what state you live in. And this is a global issue, but in terms of America, there are people who have the exact same diagnosis and potential future with a disease that is incurable. It's lung cancer is the leading cause of cancer death in America and around the world. But if you live in my home state of Alabama and you are on Medicaid, I am not on Medicaid, but if you are on Medicaid, the testing for this biomarker that would mean you'd get this medication I am taking is not available. It is not covered by Medicaid. So if you're in California, you could get that medication. If you are in Tennessee, you could get that medication. But if you are just a mile over the border in Alabama, or if you live in Virginia, you can't get it. I mean, it is 60% of the states in the United States don't have coverage for that in Medicaid. It's so, you know, we live in a country that's so full of inequities. And so it's been, I have felt really a call to use my personal story as a window into the larger issue of inequity, which is just vast and full of so much confusion. But it's been really educational for me. And I thought I was aware of all the inequities. But nope, there are more.
Yeah, I mean, you do a really powerful job of that, too, in some of your more recent essays for us. So maybe we'll share that at the end. So just closing up this section of our conversation, Katha, you're also a poet, and this collection contains a lot of poetry, which has surprised some readers, I think pleasantly, but it was important to me to include poetry, just I'm also a poet. And is there a role for poetry in the fight against poverty and for greater political clarity? Like, do you see, I know you may see that sort of milk and meat poetry and your reporting, but I'm wondering if you see that there's a job that poetry can do in a sense.
Well, I think that we're in a moment where politically oriented poetry is tremendously popular, and spoken word poetry, Black poets are really having a moment. It's beautiful to see. And so I think that a lot of stories are being told that weren't told so much before. I myself tend to like poems that aren't too preachy and aren't I don't like uplifting poetry.
I don't like uplifting.
Downshifting.
Down, miserable, like Emily Dickinson and below.
Altogether. Yeah. I think poetry is definitely part of the mix now in a way that maybe it wasn't a while ago. I want to say, can I say something about Dobbs and all that? And yesterday, Election Day, was a triumph for the American people, especially the women, but also people have really woken up to the what overturning Roe has done to women's health. And I think that it's very inspiring to see that people really are making connections that as long as Roe was there, maybe they didn't make them. You know, it's that, you never miss the water till the well runs dry thing. Like, it just like, it's always going to be here. They'll never overturn it. And so then you could have all these fancy ethical dilemmas and, why can't they just put the child up for adoption, that kind of thing. So many people said that, like having a baby is just nothing. Just put it up, have it, and put it up for adoption. But I think people are making connections now that they didn't make before, which is that abortion rights are really connected to freedom, to privacy. I mean, people love to make fun of the idea of privacy and the way that Roe versus Wade is based on the idea for privacy, but they're not doing that so much anymore because it's just a very vivid picture now that some old Republican politician has more control over your body than you do or your doctor does or anybody does. And people don't like that. I think that's a sort of an interesting feature of American politics, is that there is this kind of libertarianism that can go either way. It can have very right-wing effects, and then sometimes it can have a kind of left-wing effect. So I feel very encouraged by what happened yesterday, and I think we should give ourselves a round of American applause. Yay!
You know, you don't always know when your opponent is going to overplay his hand. And after all those years when politicians said, oh, don't worry, this will be a state-by-state thing, this will be something that people choose through their legislatures, and then when they started to talk about making it illegal to travel when you're pregnant to get an abortion, a lot of people who never even thought about this as their issue, I think, suddenly said, wait a minute. Stop you from traveling? Check whether you're pregnant before you can go to the next state over? And then we'll see what overplaying a hand looks like, because that stuff started to emerge before the ink was even dry on the Dobbs decision.
Absolutely. And so I'm glad that you brought that up, because it is a moment, it's something to be cheerful, and it's part of the thing that I wanted to move into, actually. What are some things that we actually have hope about? And this includes, what are directions? I mean, for Annabelle, your experience on the SAG lines or the writer's strike, you know, Alex, you know, youngest person on the panel, your friends think are reasons to be optimistic about your fortunes, you know,
et cetera? I'll just speak really briefly about the SAG after Writers Guild strike, which I'm a member of all three unions. I think it is, first of all, it is a situation in terms of the people who toil in these unions, much like other employments in America. We've seen the wage gap grow so much between CEO pay and then the actual workers who make the sausage pay. And, you know, I think there's been, we've seen a real sacrifice on the part of workers and solidarity with raising money for people who work what used to be called below the line, the crew members, and how we are all really determined to make some real change here. But of course, I mean, so many unions have been on strike, but I think that has also helped to demystify a little bit some of the mythology around people who create film, television, and, you know, most of the actors in the union make less than $30,000 a year. And I think it's important that these things are talked about, and it's important, but it's caused a lot of suffering. People have really taken a stand, and I do think it's positive to see how much people are just going to the mat for basic wages and fairness in sharing a company's profit, like the streaming and the entertainment companies. But it's come at a sacrifice. People are really suffering.
Yeah.
I find positivity in things like going for broke, you know. Aww. To me, it's a deep dive into the different kinds of citizenship that we have as American citizens. And I don't just mean with the story about David Wallace getting wrongfully detained at the Canadian border. I'm not just talking about the story that Anne Elizabeth Moore writes about Tamika Langford, where there's the difference in citizenship between the housing of a white woman and a black woman in Detroit, you know. And I'm also not just talking about the different kind of citizenship that you feel as a veteran coming back from overseas and not being allowed to be a member of the society that you left. There's a thing in America where you can be as red, white, and blue as a bald eagle if you want to be. But it doesn't matter, because if you get arrested for your skin color, or if you get carted off because you cannot pay your rent anymore, or mistreated because you're a veteran, you will find very quickly how little people care about you being here. You will find that people do not treat you like the rest of society. They don't think that you're a part of a United States of America. They will treat you like you don't belong here. So I find positivity in the fact that these stories are getting told, because it just brings us closer to where we should be. There's also, I got a thing coming up with Invisible Americans. You'll be there, which is a podcast that talks about child poverty and the ways in which we can cut down on it. I just recently worked with the Jed Foundation, which is an organization, nonprofit organization, that uses games and the metaverse and therapy to cut down on childhood suicide, because the second leading cause amongst people from the ages of 10 to 34 is death by suicide. And I work with an organization called Stack Up that helps to produce positive results in veterans with mental health issues. So I can find positivity throughout all of the things that I do.
Alex, you're actually giving me reasons to hope, just like listening to you. Like, all right, because I actually was like, what would I actually say if one of you guys turned it on me? I was like, I think I'd probably say Ohio, but and Kansas, but and the abortion response. But so yeah, that's amazing that you're doing all that, and that there's space and people are understanding, at least some people, that we need to be more inclusive of various people in the nonprofit sector and in journalism, et cetera. Katha, what gives you hope? Is it, are we back to Ohio? Or are we back to, what gives you hope in the media though? So this is a media book after all. I mean, a lot of the people here are journalists.
Well, just to mention one thing in the media that we saw Killers of the Flower Moon a few days ago, which is an amazing movie about terrible murders of Native Americans, as we Osage Indians, who had a great deal of oil wealth in Oklahoma, and they were murdered by white men mostly to get the money. And this movie was made by Martin Scorsese, who's in his 80s, if not his 90s, starring baby daddy Robert De Niro, who is 80-something.
Yes, the opposite of a Nepo baby. I don't know, or the producer of Nepo Babies.
He was fantastic. Yeah. You would never think this man was too old to be a great movie star. So Ray Suarez should take hope from that. It was an incredible movie. And I thought, well, people are still making valuable art, and I take hope from that. Sometimes that's all the hope I have. I think things are pretty bad, and the large picture is not good.
If Trump gets
all over, we've got to prevent that from happening.
Yes, That is absolutely. And finally, I'm going to let Ray answer this question. You know, it's a time when brain work has become gig work and journalists poster children for precarious middle class. And so what gives you hope in times of divisions and violence? Like you've seen a lot of them historically, you've reported on them, right? So, but now and previous ones, like what gets you out of it?
It's like, well, you know, Alyssa, reporters hate to be wrong. But I went up and down and I'm back up again. When the fight for 15 and the sort of shout from the shoproom floor began before the pandemic, I was following that closely. And the pandemic sort of crystallized what I hoped would be a moment where people would finally be able to be honest about what this tech bro utopian soft sell about gig work had come to mean. And this idea that, oh, you make your own hours, yes, but you also become your own business manager and your own accountant and your own equipment manager and yeah. your own insurance broker. And you have to also save for your own retirement because there's not a program at work anymore because there isn't work. Who am I working for today is the question that you're asking. So I thought, oh, here's a moment. We're going to have a moment where we actually pay attention to this stuff. And it seemed to have been lost. Everybody just said, like they did after the 1918 pandemic, oh, glad that's over. Let's get back to normal. And people stopped talking about it, and I worried. But I really feel that we're playing a much longer game. And in fact, there is room. And the book is evidence of that, but it's not the only evidence of that. People are willing to think about and talk about what low-wage work really means, what people's lives are really like, and what this employerless world where we're all walking around as individual contractors is really going to look like, apart from, you know, that vote in California when at-will gig workers got voted down because people just didn't want to spend any more money for the stuff they were making gig workers scramble around and do. I think California will over time rethink that, and other states will look at what California did as gig work becomes more normalized and the lives of real workers. You'll know somebody in that predicament. It won't just be something that you hear about or see covered in a story on television or read about in Going for Broke. I actually, after being encouraged, then discouraged, I'm back to being encouraged again.
Oh, wow, Ray. Ray's encouraged. I feel encouraged. So I think we're going to start to turn it to the audience unless anyone has any last thoughts on the panel. We have probably a few minutes, 3 minutes before we're going to turn it to the audience. So anybody want to speak their truth?
One thing, let me say one thing. I'm not proud of it. And you know, people, when that essay appeared in the Washington Post, people said, oh, you were so brave to write that. And I thought, oh, God, give me a break. It was just a payday in part because this was driving me crazy and I wrote about it and it got printed. So I got paid. But I didn't put in that essay that I had just completed treatment for cancer because I was afraid at that point that I would become entirely unemployable if I said to the world that I had had cancer. And it's not something that I'm particularly proud of. It wasn't a profile in courage moment, but I really believed, and I think with justification, that if I said, oh, you know, not only am I falling down the stairs, but I got cancer too, forget it. You know, nobody was going to give me a job. And so I didn't put it in, even though that was really an important thing that was happening in my life right then and also making me think a lot about my future as a worker. So it is also very much part of the story of insecurity and precarity of men in their 60s who start having shorter and shorter job tenures at lower and lower pay after age 59. So it's not just a me story. It's a widespread phenomenon among men who continue to work. And, you know, what are all the big voices in the culture saying? They're saying, oh, don't retire too early. Keep working. And then when you want to keep working, they put all these roadblocks in your way. Sorry. I mean, I keep reading now that the inflation is ravaging people's fixed income checks again. You know, they're saying, oh, you know, don't look at what's happening. Don't retire so early.
Thanks for sharing that, Ray. And it is brave, whatever. You can say it's not, but it is brave. It was brave. So we have our first question from the audience. Can you talk a bit about how readers are responding to your essays? How are your words impacting folks? So I know from conversations with all of you about the ways that you guys have, but maybe not Katha, but ways that these personal pieces that you publish about your own struggles and adjacency to struggle have like gotten personal emails from people you've known, but also sometimes not particularly friendly ones, right, Ray? You've gotten some antagonistic emails. So do you want to talk a little bit about that, or and then we'll go around?
Well, even though I was very upfront about the fact that, you know, I wasn't going to be driven into the poorhouse, I'm sitting in my own house here. That this kind of insecurity can happen all up and down the wage ladder. People were very ungenerous in their reactions to what I wrote. It got 4,000 comments on the Washington Post website, and they were split among people who said, look, if it can happen to this guy, it can happen to anybody. Some people said, the same thing happened to me, and here's my story. And then a bunch said, he probably sent his kids to private school and drove nice cars, you know, and I'm supposed to feel bad for him. Well, I didn't. And that wasn't the point of the story anyway. But it showed, you know, there's a lot of walking wounded out there, and they are not inclined to be generous, and they're not inclined to be empathetic. They were more inclined to say, oh, yeah, this rich guy is writing about his economic problems, cry me a river. Interestingly, one young woman journalist said I was blind to my own privilege. And I thought, you know, when I read that, I thought, oh, man, you know, I lost about 90% of my income, literally 90% of my income. And I was chemoed out and reading that and thinking, oh, man, leave me alone. You know, I just I thought, just that's the one that really got to me. I thought, oh, God.
These comments, I call them the peanut gallery. They can be, I mean, we get them a lot at Eat Your Pea, and you get ones that are incredibly supportive. And you maybe should tell us, because I know you, and I know also that a lot of colleagues in media wrote to me about your piece, Ray. They said, you know, I want to give Ray Suarez work. I want to, you know, this moved me. This spoke to me. I've been there. I was laid off from X or Y, and now I'm employed again. And I love him. He's like, you know, been with me my whole life. He has a voice that I'm listening to, or I've worked with him, you know. So I think it also did. There are people who are very affected, you know. I mean, you must have gotten the personal emails too, right?
Yes, and a lot of people were really lovely. I don't want to leave the impression that there's just a bunch of jerks out there.
Right. Yeah.
I want to mention that when, you know, this piece was published, people wrote on my social media. There were people who published photographs of guns saying, I should have had a gun with me. Wasn't I afraid for my life? And one of the things I tried to make clear in this essay about, you know, taking in youth experiencing homelessness, I was afraid for my life. And what I didn't realize and what I learned is what, of course, they were more frightened for their lives than I was for my own, because their experience in being unhoused had made them so vulnerable to crimes. They had also both had system involvement, and so they weren't sure, even though this is a vetted program, if I was some sort of predator running some sort of, you know, sex recruitment ring, or I was, you know, if something happened at my house and police came at all, what would people, what would the immediate, we know this kind of thing happens if police show up, you know, who is assumed to be at fault? I mean, they were really terrified that they might be in danger staying in my house, or a neighbor might wonder why they were at my house since they weren't known in the neighborhood. And, you know, that was really eye-opening for me to realize that. But also when I saw these pictures of people posting guns, now this was right before the pandemic and also before Trump was elected, but I wasn't as surprised by January 6th when I had already received this kind of response. I also got people wanting to know about the host home program. But it's sort of a funny thing you might relate to, Ray. You know, I was really writing, and I also to take away and address some of the taboo around economic insecurity. And I think one of the things that we are all reflecting on in this book is there are different levels of economic insecurity, and all of them coexist together and make a web, as it's very important and much more urgent, yes, to talk about the living below the poverty line in America, but you don't want to see the middle class fall without a safety net. We want to see a middle class so that we're not overburdening society. And just a funny little note. So, you know, I did get a lot of support about from this piece as well. And someone in my community invited me out to lunch to talk about the piece. And I was really excited about it because I knew she's a wealthy person who also has a foundation that works with unhoused youth. And after lunch, she said, so we'll split the check. And I thought, did you not read my piece? What? I was so excited. I hadn't gone out to a restaurant in such a long time when she had invited me out. It was not like I posted this. I was so excited. I kind of ordered a lot of food, and I just was not going to restaurants. This was part of my budget, but I didn't know in that moment, face to face, I said, okay. And I have a regret. It's not something that I've published, but I wish I had said after that lunch, are you fucking kidding me? Did you not read what I wrote? You're paying, lady. And I didn't. Damn it.
That's very funny. That, I mean, I have many stories like this too. I mean, I call this in my book before Bootstraps, the middle precariat. And I think the precarious proletariat middle class, right? And one of the reasons it's important to highlight this isn't just that we need a strong middle class, but also that if people are able to express this, their own kind of slipping down feeling, and they may have more solidarity with people up and down the gradient. Like it's builds continuity actually between classes, instead of being like, okay, we're so different. It's like, actually they're sort of variations. There are things that we're all experiencing right now. We're experiencing loss of steady jobs over our lifetimes. We're the gig work effect of lack of healthcare. You know, it's like these are true in different populations. And so, yeah, some people are obviously, it's, you don't want to like be blind to your privilege, but you also don't want to elide the problems that are existing in the middle class, because you want to show the connections. Yeah.
One thing I was able to also do in addressing people's comments was some people would comment on social media or in the comments in that piece, and I didn't answer people. I never answer people on a media site, but in social media, I was answering people who would write things like, well, I don't know people who are homeless, but I think blah, blah. And I said, yes, you do. every time someone comes to your house to deliver a DoorDash, to every Uber you get into, you really need to think about that. You are interacting with people experiencing homelessness every day. If you think that you are somehow living in a separate world, you're not. You are potentially getting into someone's home when you take that ride.
Yeah, this is part of why we call our organization the Economic Hardship Reporting Project. It's not just the Poverty Reporting Project, to show that there's instability up and down the income gradients. So, Alex, so how have people responded to you? Do you have any things that really stand out?
Yeah. Actually, a few vets, multiple amputee vets, spoke to me about my writing, which was very, very touching, because they felt that they were being heard, you know, their struggles with the VA and not being attended to properly, their bouts with depression and wanting to end it all. I got some very good messages, and then I also got some interviews because of things that I've written for vets. So it's encouraging. And I know that I had to learn kind of early how you can get in trouble by interacting with people through like Twitter. So I made that decision that, you know, okay, that there are only certain things that I will respond to, even if they're positive, on the internet, because some people are just out there to get you, and that's their entire purpose. And I use that example of, right before we discovered how much of a raging anti-Semite Kanye West was, the year before that, I wrote about him, but like, you know, it was this kind of enduring way about how he inspired my early life when College Dropout first came out. And then I wrote another piece. Somebody dug that piece up and brought it into the conversation. And they're like, oh, you love Kanye West, huh? Like, come on, man. This was last year. And it was not. This isn't even what we're talking about, you know? People will do that. They'll interject something very negative that will completely distort the conversation. You could be talking about gummy bears and somebody be like, you're racist. Okay.
Which is another reason why journalists and people who write and produce work for public consumption need support, right? They need support from institutions and organizations, and not just being all out there on their own, because otherwise you can be open to these kind of attacks and unprotected. So we have another question here. One issue we've seen is how often stress from poverty is framed as mental illness. Oh, everyone's going to have lots of thoughts on this. With solutions of go to therapy and do yoga, thoughts on how to combat that harmful narrative? And that's a very Barbara question. I think it's a good place to end, actually, where, you know, Barbara Ehrenreich and her Bright Sided really critique that positive thinking as a recipe for helping anybody out of almost anything. So.
I wish therapy was free. That'd be great. I know that that's a major issue in America. Of course, you have to protect your mind. That's all you have. As soon as that goes, nothing else really matters. And so when people do say things like, you know, go to therapy or do yoga, that's great that you can say that. But actually doing it, digging into pocket for the costs that come along with monitoring your health in a society like ours, where, well, like Ray, you had to decide whether you're going to get insurance or, you know, like to make that decision between getting health for yourself or eating. It is very harmful to think in terms like that. You know, when you're on the street and you need help and you need to speak to somebody, well, who cares at that point? Like, who's really going to bring, you know, lend you an olive branch when you don't even have an address?
One of the people we profiled in the Going for Broke audio series was a working person, was not earning wages that would qualify them from their employer for health care. They knew they needed mental health care. But on Medicaid, if you want to use Medicaid to get treatment for your mental health problems, you have to find a doctor who's going to accept Medicaid as payment. It's often offered as Medicaid will get that. And the heroine of our story, at the core of our story, tells this beautiful, moving story about knowing how you need help, being self-aware, knowing you need help, knowing that you can't really work well unless you get that help. So, you know, that adds an extra spin to the whole thing because you want to work to lift yourself up, but it's becoming so hard to work because you know you've got clinical depression. And the inability to find someone who would treat her depression and take Medicaid in payment. It was like chasing your tail. Terrible.
The writer's name was Katie Prout, and she actually, she's appeared in a few of our Going for Broke our media, different media that Ray and I have produced around EHRP. And one of the striking things from that story was that she was ghosted by a therapist in Medicaid. I was like, what? I would have been a psychiatrist. Like, she found one person who would take Medicaid, and then that person, she spoke to them for like half an hour, and then they never called her back. And she called them multiple times. So what do you think, Katha? Do you think that there's, what do you think when people tell people to go do yoga when they're engaged in trying to earn a living with multiple jobs or just struggling in other ways?
Well, you know, Barbara, I think she took a very harsh line, a harder line than I would take. I mean, I think if people should do things that make themselves feel better. And if it makes them feel better to take a nice bath with a whole bunch of candles around the rim and, you know, put a bubble bath in there, great, you know. If it makes them feel better to do yoga, I mean, it would make me feel worse to do yoga. I hate yoga, but it would make them feel better. Go for it. But, you know, these things are, many of them are not cheap. And so it's to tell someone who's living on the street, oh, you should take yoga. Well, how are they going to do that? You know, but a lot of times we know that depression is helped by exercise, by walks, by there are things that, you know, people can do that may help. I think that therapy is great. I don't know what Barbara thought about that, but everyone I know has been, including me, has been in therapy for a long time. I find it very helpful. So I would never say, what is the alternative? What is the alternative? You can't spend all your time making the revolution. So in the time that's left, you wanted to say something, Annabelle.
I just wanted to say one of the things I hoped I did in writing about the couple who gave me permission to tell their story. I did not get permission from the bunny, unfortunately, and I did tell the bunny story. But, was a realization on my part of how incredibly hardworking and time consuming their lives were. They were door dashing. They were also collecting electric scooters to return to charge to make money. They were looking for work. Just the every single step that hadn't occurred to me of exactly how little time they had. It really made me think about time is the ultimate privilege. time to take care of yourself, time to do anything like that. And just to say what Barbara, I could never speak for, dream of speaking for Barbara, but having just been reading this today, I am reminded that as Barbara was, as she said, a gym rat, right? She loved working out. So she loved these kinds of things. But I think one of the point of views she was driving to in Brightsided was the idea that very often this is sort of code for get therapy, do yoga, that you should be able to solve all your problems yourself. That's the self-reliance and that it, the problem with your being in poverty is you're not doing enough to get yourself out of it. I think that's the part of the narrative that
the problem of being sick is it's your fault, or it's the again, the individualization. But I mean, I met some of her friends after she passed away, and one of them was a hugely muscular 78-year-old blonde woman. I was like, oh, how do you know her? She's like, oh, we lifted weights together. I was like, okay. And it was like just her gym crowd, and they were like platinum blonde and really, really built. I think, you know, we may be signing off now, but before I go, I wanted to thank our amazing panelists, Ray Suarez, Annabelle Gerwich, Katha Pollitt, and Alex Miller. I also want you to go read by Going for Broke, listen to the podcast Going for Broke. Hopefully the folks at Haymarket will be sharing these links in which Ray, Annabelle, Alex, and myself all appear. And also check out our organization's site, economichardship.org. Hopefully Haymarket will be sharing the details in the chat and how to pitch us, info@economichardship.org if you're a writer, how to donate to us, and about having any of us on your shows to talk about. If you have your own podcast, if you want us on, you can also write to info@economichardship.org about that. But we are very open as an organization to new ideas and different people's voices. I see this book as sort of the beginning of a set potentially of projects that will have a longer life than just a single article that our organization produces. We've done films and series and things like that. Any final words, my friends, before we sign off?
My pub date is April 23rd, so buy my book.
Oh, your book. Okay. What's your book?
It's called We Are Home, Becoming American in the 21st Century, and it's about the latest iteration of America's immigrant story. And after you finish reading Going for Broke, you can start reading that.
Go walk over in the bookstore. All right. Thank you again. And it was wonderful to be here with you all and to chat with you tonight. And hopefully we'll continue the conversation.
Thanks for listening. If you like this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.